Morning to everyone. We will start the class in just about a minute or two. Hope everybody had a good weekend and is having a good weekend. We'll be taking up a topic today regarding whether God has favorites or not, and referring to the blessings of Isaac and also to the prayers of King Solomon. And we will start just momentarily. Today is Genesis 27, and in Kings 1, chapter 8, around the area of verse 41. We'll take a few verses there.
Norman, are you still there?
Hello.
Hi, Riley. How you doing?
Hi, Doug. Good morning. How are you?
Good. I'm excellent. Thanks.
Good morning.
Good morning, Cal. How are you doing? By the way, tomorrow, I think it's not going to be good for me. Possibly we can do it Tuesday, that conference we're going to have?
I won't be here, but...
I can do it on Tuesday. We're doing that at 7 Pacific, 10 Eastern?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that'd work
for me, too.
Okay. Oh, hi, Josh.
Hi.
We got Josh and Sean and Bond on the line.
Okay, hello to everybody. How are you?
Hi. Good.
Okay, Tuesday, 7 p.m.
And you'll send that. I guess it's just a few of us, so, right.
Yeah, we'll send something out.
Right. And good work again, Doug, on that, the fundamentals for the non-Jew are really good.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. More than half of it went in just three pages, and we'll finish it up next week.
Oh, okay, great. Thank you. Well, I've got theoretically 9 more chapters to go.
Okay. All right, so what I wanted to take up today is something interesting I came across. Actually, a friend of mine is in Israel, and he was helping out at a soup kitchen. He took his whole family there. And so they spent, a number of hours helping out the poor, the destitute, and, and when he was there was one Israeli that appears to be like a self-hating Jew. And he says, us Jews were really, liars. And he was referring to when Jacob lied to his father Isaac, who was blind, and he took the blessings. Jacob, first of all, rightfully took those blessings because he bought them from his brother, Esav. And Esav really didn't care. I mean, he actually despised them. That was not really what he wanted in life. And it apparently, it was Rebekah's advice to Jacob when she saw that, Isaac was nearing his last days, that she suggested that he goes in and dresses up as his brother and puts on animal skins, because Esav was evidently a very... hairy-skinned person, almost like an animal's type of a fur. So she put on the goat skins on his arms and his neck, and in order that he would appear to his blind father as his brother, so his father would give him the blessings. But he did it rightfully. He did it actually through, Rivka also. Rebecca also had suggested this whole thing. And clearly Jacob doesn't say it was wrong. He just says, maybe my father will find out. But he didn't say it was a wrong action. So here you have two righteous people, prophets, that realize that there are certain times when you are allowed to lie. A good example would be any time today a person wants to kill you, you can lie, and you should lie, and you must lie to save your life. So lying is not an absolute. Actually, King Solomon talks about in chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes, he says there's a time for everything. That means to say that nothing is an absolute. To to say that there's a time for everything means there's nothing which is absolute. The only things which are absolute are God. That's, you know, that's something which is that, you know, God is unchanging. He is perfect, so that there's no change in that which is perfect. I think we're going a little far afield, but I just wanted to just a little background on what happened over there. Now, interesting thing is, is that when he gives the blessings, when Isaac gives the blessings, thinking it's his son Esau, and at this point he still had a good estimation of Esau. So he says, that God, he uses God's name of Elohim, and the word, there's different names for God, they indicate different concepts. The term Elohim, when we use it in reference to man, we can say it, so it's Elohim, which means a judge, someone who administers justice. And when we use it as a reference to God, or when the Torah uses that term, it's referring to an aspect of judgment. So when Isaac was blessing Yaakov, you know, Jacob, but it was ostensibly Esau at that point because he was blind and he didn't know that, you know, Jacob had come in. So in Isaac's estimation, this was still a good son. And he said that God, Elohim, should give you from the dew of the heavens. I'm reading right now, it's Genesis 27:28. He says that God should give you from the dew of the heavens and from the fat places of the earth, and much grain, and then wine. Then, later on, when Esau finally is found out, and Isaac is terrified that Jacob was able to take the blessings, that means there was something wrong with Esau. And Isaac didn't know this. It says in 33 that Isaac trembled, he feared a great fear, a great trembling. Very much, it says, exceedingly. Why was he so afraid? Evidently, when he saw that Jacob successfully took the blessings, that means that Esau wasn't deserving, and Isaac had a wrong estimation of Esau. So nonetheless, he still gives him a blessing after Esau pleads with him. So, because first Isaac says, I have no blessings left, I gave them to your brother. So finally he gives in and he says that he'll give him a blessing. But here he says the same thing pretty much. He says, let's see. He says, yeah, in 27:39, now when he's blessing Esau, knowing that he wasn't as good as he thought, he again says that you should get from the fat of the land, and it should be a dwelling places, and from the dew of the heavens. But here he doesn't say God's name. So Rashi on the spot says something very interesting. He says that there are agadic interpretations, and he says as following, but there has to be a true idea. You know, the Agada, that things that were stated over by the rabbis, there are truths there. So sometimes they're metaphoric, sometimes they're not. Here it's not a case of metaphor. Here he says as follows. So Rashi asked the question, why is it when Isaac was blessing, the first blessing, to who we thought was a good, upright Esau, there he uses the term God, Elohim, judgment, but later on he doesn't. So he says, Elohim here, what does it mean? It means that you should get the dew of the heavens and the fat places of earth if you're fitting to get it, meaning it all depends on reward and punishment. He was blessing his son and saying that God should give you, administer the just thing for you. If you're not acting properly, then he should withhold it. Okay? Right, so he says, if you're fitting, you should get it. If not, you should not get it. But to Esau, later on, when Isaac knew it was Esau, who was not as up to par as he thought, he said just unconditionally that you should get all this good. That means that it should not depend upon your level, which is astonishing, because it sounds like he is giving a greater blessing, an unconditional blessing. He's praying to God that Esau should get the good life regardless of his actions, whereas Jacob shouldn't. And Jacob, we know, is more perfected. So with Rashi's encyclopedic knowledge of the Torah, he immediately calls our attention to an exact same case. And he says, from this, from Isaac's words, did King Solomon learn. And when he made the temple, he ordered his prayer to God. When he was first talking about Israel, who was already knowledgeable of God and trusting in God, he said that God, when the Jews come to the temple and pray to you, you should give to each man his in accordance with his way. Right? Just like Isaac said to Jacob. Because you know the hearts of men. But when King Solomon prays about God responding to the Gentile that comes to the temple, he does not say that it should depend upon his ways, that God should grant him only depending upon his ways. But there again he says, you should give him unconditionally. You should do to that Gentile all that they call upon you to do, whether they are fitting or whether they are not fitting. All right? A duplication. And again, Rashi says it openly, that King Solomon duplicated, he copied, he learned from Isaac. Okay. All right, so you see the question, right?
Yes, I do.
Right? We see it's a theme. It's not just a one-time occurrence. Okay. So what is always the... I mean, let me first let's stop here for a moment and see if there's any questions that you have before we continue.
I guess my only question is figuring out why it's set up that way.
Right. And what does it mean? I mean, it seems to be we always see that the Torah is completely fair. There's complete equality.
You mean that the Gentiles aren't able to have the same potential?
Just the opposite. Everywhere in the Torah, it says clearly, and numerous times the Torah says that the Gentile keeps all the system and observes the Torah like a Jew. He has to observe the exact same thing as a Jew. No difference. Meaning there's no difference. Once a Gentile would be observing the Torah system, he has the same exact reward and punishment, same exact providence, same exact laws. Again, you know, I always stress the fact that you have to realize that we all come from the same couple. There's no difference in the design between a person who's born to Jewish parents or a person who's born to non-Jewish parents. No difference in the design at all. That's what makes these areas that we just quoted problematic. The potential is there, equal. And again, the leader of the Jewish nation was not a Jew, Abraham. He was a Gentile. No different than a Gentile today. And again, our greatest king is King Solomon, and King David all came from Gentile, from Ruth. And the Messiah is going to be coming from that line as well. So you see that we don't have any type of favoritism.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Is it possible that what they're saying is that God should help the Gentiles in a sense because they're, I don't know how else to say this, at a lower level, that he should help them, provide them their needs and so forth, but that the Jewish people, because they're on a higher level and are focused on, for lack of a better term, spiritual development, he should provide that to them if they're deserving, so that if they don't get it, they will be prompted to improve. But he doesn't have that expectation of the Gentiles.
So why is there a disparity?
Because it's, I guess, more is expected of the Jewish people because of their position with Hashem.
Okay. Agreed.
So that might be like a king who makes sure that all the servants in his palace are well fed, but for his son, he might, under certain circumstances, withhold a meal in order to encourage his son to learn or teach him some lesson that he needs to learn.
Right.
In other words, we would almost automatically look at it and say, well, see, if you get everything, that means you're more favored. But in fact, in Hashem's system, that's, I think, exactly the opposite. That what's really important is the growth of your soul, and that the physical things that it appears these verses are referring to are secondary and are only there to help you improve your soul, so that by putting the condition on it that the Jews be worthy, that sets them up to be able to go after the real good.
That seems to be rejecting the good for the Gentile, then. It sounds like it's crippling the Gentile, unwarranted. You're allowing the Jews...
I don't know that it's crippling them so much as it's not having the same expectation of them, in the same sense that the king doesn't have the same expectation for the janitor in his palace as he does for his own son, who he expects to follow in his ways more closely.
I don't agree that the expectation is less.
Okay.
I think there's a different reason for it. Because again, why should the expectation be less if we're all the exact same design?
Can it be that Jacob wanted the blessing?
Could be the what?
Because Jacob wanted the blessing and Esau did not want it.
Well, that would be fine in that case. But the language that Isaac used, though, is not explained by that theory. And nor is what King Solomon did. A little louder?
Say that again?
You want me to say what I said again?
Yeah.
Yeah, that it was... That you're speaking from Jacob's perspective, that he wanted the blessings. That's fine, but we're trying to understand why Isaac changed the principle when he blessed his two different sons, and also why King Solomon had a different principle. So you're addressing Jacob. We're trying to understand the intent of Isaac, which King Solomon saw as being a proper and a just approach, and which he duplicated when he prayed to God regarding both the Jew and the Gentile.
Rabbi?
Yes.
So, variation. So, possibly Hashem gives the blessing, or the intent is for Hashem to give the blessing of all the physical things to the Gentiles, in the hope that by receiving those they will recognize the abundance that they've been given and that there must be a creator behind that and seek after the creator in order to grow. But for Jacob, and in King Solomon's time for the Jewish people, they already knew about Hashem. They'd been given that knowledge. And so the approach taken to try to improve them was to add in the concept of worthiness in order to move them to a higher level.
Okay, so you're saying that they're two different... Or they both have the same potential, or they don't, the Jew and Gentile?
Yeah, they both have the same potential, but with the Gentiles, it's like you're starting with someone. It would kind of be like, are you starting with a first grader, or are you starting with a high schooler?
Okay.
And you want they all have the same potential, ultimately, and you want them to achieve everything they can, but you're going to deal with the first grader because they lack knowledge in a different way than you would deal with a high schooler who's got more knowledge.
Okay, very good. Now let me read you the Radak, who's a really great commentator, Rav David Kimchi. Now he's commenting on some of the... Of course, the approach we always take to answer, you know, any question is to look at the verses. There's a whole science to the verses. So the very area that brings us the question is going to also give us the answer. The rabbis actually say that. They say that the answer is right next to the question. So we have to be sensitive to the verses, because that's exactly how the Torah was written. And that's how we improve in our learning, is we understand the way the Torah is written, and we start learning how the answers are embedded in the verse itself. So let's take a look at the verse. The verse is in Kings 1, chapter 8, verse 41, 42, and 43. Those verses. All right, so it's Kings 1, chapter 8, verses 41, 42, and 43. I'll read it. And King Solomon says, "And also to the Gentile that is not of your people Israel, and he comes from a distant land, in order for the sake of your name." Right, verse 42. "And he hears of your name, your great name, and your great, your mighty arm, and your outstretched arm, and he comes to pray to you at this house." And number three, here's the crucial verse. So he says, "You, God, listen from the heavens, the place of your dwelling, and do for him all that he asks of you, of the Gentile." Okay, that's one part of this verse. Next part of the verse, "In order that that all the people, all the inhabitants of the land will know your name, to fear you like your people Israel, and to know that your name is called in this house which I built." So what is he saying? He's saying, early when he said about the Jew, he said in 39, he says, "Gift each man according to his ways." That's in 39. Right? Kings 1, 8, verse 39. He says to God, "Listen from the heavens, the place of his dwelling, and forgive, and do, and give to man, each man according to his ways, because you know his heart, because you alone know the hearts of all the sons of man." But that's by the Jew, that he says, use justice, do it in accordance with his actions. When it says regarding the Gentile, again, in 40, he says, 41, excuse me, "Also to the Gentile you should, that comes and from a distant land, and he's coming." Evidently the Gentile here is inclined towards investigating God, because it says he's coming from a distant land for your name's sake. So his prayer is that you give him everything he asks unconditionally, in order that what? In order that he should know, in order that all the people of the land should know your name, to fear you like Israel. So it's just like you said, Doug. The difference is that the starting point of a kindergartner or a high schooler are two different points. So there's no nepotism, there's no favoritism of King Solomon or Isaac. What they were saying is that in terms of a process of education, and Maimonides said this himself in the beginning of his Guide for the Perplexed, that he was talking to his student, Joseph, that he wanted him to see ideas in a certain order. The certain ideas, they should present themselves in a certain order to him, meaning that certain ideas you cannot proceed before other ideas. You have to go in a sequence in order that your education is proper. So let's think like this, that the Gentile would come to the temple and he would pray and he wouldn't get anything. So what type of initial impression would he have about this God of the Jews that he's heard so much about? He might feel that he's inept, he can't respond, or he doesn't like me. So when you're first starting out, so if a person doesn't really have the ideas yet, he doesn't understand. So the first thing he has to have, what's the first concept he must have about God? He's a creator. He is the sole governor of the universe. He created it, and therefore he maintains it and can respond to a person's requests, whereas no other quote-unquote God can. And when the Gentile would see this, that he comes to the temple and he prays and he gets a response to anything he asks, that will give him that lesson. This will basically be like a miniature revelation at Sinai, when the Jews witnessed the Creator undeniably. So now he will see this. So you see, the God is using the same method, that the first thing that the person must have is this realization that this is the real God. This is the one that he prayed at the temple. His whole life he's praying at idols and so on and so forth. Now he prays at the Jewish temple, and he gets a response. And he hears from other people too. They're getting a response too. So they're all amazed. We actually found out about the real Creator, because this is the only one that ever responded to us. Once that happens, now there's an opening in his heart to the recognition that this is the real God. Then, like King Solomon says, he says that if you do this and you give him all the requests, in order that all the people of the land should know your name and they'll fear you just like the Jew. So you see, King Solomon's goal is that the Gentiles should have the exact same lot in life as the Jew. He did not have any type of idea that there's any less status, and no less potential either. But the starting point has to be considered. So that's why Isaac also did the same thing with Esau. He needed to have an opening in his heart as well to get him back onto the right track. So that's why Isaac said he didn't use the term Elohim to determine justice, that God should give you your requests just in terms of your level of deservance. No, he said to Esau also, God should give it to you unconditionally. Because in both cases, these individuals, Esau and also the Gentile in the time of King Solomon, required to have the first step, and that is conviction that the God of the Jews is the only God. And how is that proven? Because when the Gentile prays and then he gets a response, no matter what he prays for, now he's awed by this. Wow, this is really the true God. And the other ones that I thought were true are really false. Once he has that first primary fundamental, now you can start teaching the fine points about that there's reward and punishment. And this may not always be the case. You may pray in the future, but now God works with a certain system of your level. But that's for good also, because when he doesn't give you what you ask for, it's because it's not a good thing for you. And then it'll allow you to reflect and see, why am I not receiving what I'm looking for? And that will help you steer you and refine your prayers to abandon hopes and wishes and things that are going to be hurtful. So you see that this is why he said it. But the goal is right in the verse. And that's what the Rav David he says, right? He says as follows. Now let me read the Radak. He says on 43, on verse 43, that you should do all that they call unto you. So Radak says like this, even though the Gentile, and he's talking about the Gentiles of King Solomon's time, he says, even though they are not fitting to have such a blessing, but he says, nonetheless, listen to their prayers. But the Israelites, right, the Jews, give each man according to his way, because you know the hearts of man. But by the Gentile, even though his heart is not upright yet, do everything which he asks, in order that all the inhabitants of the land will know your name. And because of this, the Radak says, they will know you, and they will fear you, just like the Jews. Meaning, you see, he says openly, it's a process. Okay, so it's like you were saying, Doug. And it's also an amazing thing, too, that you see King Solomon is studying the previous works. He's studying the life of Isaac, and he saw what Isaac did, and that's how he learned it. It's the first time I actually saw this in the Torah, where you see that, because normally the personality that you study in the Torah, he's got his own unique lessons that he's giving you. But here, it's not that case. King Solomon is duplicating what he learned from Isaac, which is it's a really nice thing to say. You see how and King Solomon was one of the wisest men ever to live. He was given a miraculous dose of knowledge at 12 years old when he became king. God came to him in a vision and said, ask what I should give to you. So he didn't ask for the death of his enemies or for riches. He asked for knowledge to judge the people. So God then said, because you didn't ask for these, now I'm giving you all. Because he had the right relationship to enemies. It wasn't a goal in itself, and riches was not something he was looking for. He was so much concerned with his fellow Jew, So God said, ah, now I can give you the wealth, and I can give you your enemies into your hand because you're going to relate to them in the right way. And he also gave him a tremendous amount of wisdom, and it starts talking about all the great wisdom that he had. I'll give you an example in a moment. The case where the harlots brought in the baby, and he was going to cut the baby in half. Well, what was going on over there? But let's just pause for a moment here and tell me if you have any comments or questions, all right?
That's amazing to me that King Solomon worked that out, because presumably he did not have benefit of any commentators.
He did not what?
He didn't have benefit of, you know, commentators and books of exposition that we have now, so he had to just literally work it out from the verse.
Exactly. Amazing, huh?
Yeah.
He saw a whole principle just from one additional word that Isaac used. I mean, I'm sure also there was transmissions passed down, you know, verbal transmissions from the patriarchs and the matriarchs all the way down the line.
Do we have any sense whether, well, of course, the Talmud didn't exist in the same way then that it does now, because you didn't have all the discussions, right? You just had the cases being handed down?
Well, you had no Talmud at that point. The Talmud wasn't until about 2,000 years ago.
Right, but you had the oral transmission.
You had basically the Mishnah. You had the subject matter, the oral law, that from which all the discussions of the Talmud are based on.
Right.
But actually, I saw a recent comment that one rabbi says that even the Talmud was something given at Sinai. But that doesn't, you can't take that literally, because the rabbis and the Talmud didn't exist yet. It just means that the concepts of the Talmud, all that brilliance that's so much in its raw form, was embedded in the Mishnah, in those the oral law.
Yeah. That's an amazing thing.
Yeah, so here you see, the greatest Jewish king is praying that the Gentiles should have the same lot as the Jew. And the only way to get there is to have a correct starting point, which has to be different based on where you're coming from. Anybody else? Any other questions or comments?
Did Esau's kidnap blessing achieve the goal?
You see later on that Jacob is afraid that his brother is trying to kill him. And there's an actual dispute with the rabbis whether or not it was genuine love when he hugged him and kissed him after all that time. So that dispute itself lends itself to suggest that it didn't seem to really rose to a real level of perfection. It's interesting, and I'll mention on that, since you know, mentioned about King Solomon. So, what was the story over there? It was right after he got the wisdom that event took place with the that's recorded, that there was two harlots, and one slept on her child and suffocated it, and in the middle of the night she changed it with the other harlot, and then in the morning, the woman whose baby was really the live one saw this suffocated baby under her. And she realized it was not her. She recognized, and she saw that her baby was alive and in the hands of the other woman. And so that they brought the case before King Solomon. And one woman said that the dead baby is hers and the live baby is mine. And the other one said that the live baby is mine, the dead baby is hers. So it's not the exact same thing. They're both saying that the other one really is the one who slept on a baby. And the live one is mine. So King Solomon, the strange thing happens is that King Solomon repeats the words in the Torah itself, in this area of prophets itself. He says, this one says, the live baby is mine and the dead one is hers. And this one says the dead one is hers and the live baby is mine. So it's odd why he has to repeat it. You know, one of the wisest men, then why does the Torah have to say it? What's going on over there? So what does he do? He says, bring me a sword, we'll cut the baby in half, and it'll be neither to anybody. And all of a sudden, the woman who really slept on the baby says, fine, let it not be mine, let it not be hers. And the woman who was really careful with her baby, and the live one is really hers, she says, no, give it to the other woman, but don't kill it. So King Solomon said, that's the real mother. Now, on the surface, that doesn't sound like such brilliance. Of course that's going to happen. The one who really is the mother is going to have more tender mercies of the child. But what's the real brilliance over here that is being brought down? You see, to the onlooker, both women said the same thing. Both women were saying that the dead one is hers and the live one is mine. But King Solomon repeated the words because, and one of the commentators, I forget, who said it, said as follows. He says, a woman always speaks about her child first. And King Solomon had this great level of acumen, great level of wisdom, and he knew this. He knew that a woman always will speak about her child first. So when he heard one woman say, the live one is mine and the dead one is hers, he knew that was a true mother because she spoke about the live one first. The other woman who slept on a baby, she said, the dead one is hers and the live one is mine. So she put the dead one in the beginning of her claim. That means that one's really hers. But King Solomon knew that that is too subtle for a typical person to hear. And just to make a decision based on the words of the women alone, it wouldn't appear just in the eyes of all the people there. Because to everybody listening, it sounds like they both said the exact same thing. So if they come in and they say, the live one's mine, the dead one is hers, the other one says, the dead one is hers, the live one is mine, and then King Solomon takes the baby and gives it to one of the women, people are going to look and they're going to be bewildered. They both said the same thing. Why all of a sudden you're suddenly giving the baby to this one? So that's why he repeated it, because to show us, the reader, that that's really where the clue is. To repeat something, a lot of times you have that, and it shows you, it brings out something. It makes you look at it a second time. But what he did was, he now brought out into the fore the real level of of both women. He showed how the one harlot was completely careless and aggressive. But what was amazing, I think, the real brilliance that's being brought out over here is that the people recognized that the plan that King Solomon used was based purely on something that they didn't detect themselves in the words. That, I think, really pronounced to the people and why the story is here. It's not so much that he was able to evoke a certain emotional response from both women. That, I think, you know, a typical person could possibly plan out. It's not beyond the reach, I think, of most people, or an average person, let's say. But what is beyond the reach in terms of the wisdom is that the sensitivity to the words and also to plan something which the rest of the people would appreciate, that King Solomon did not just respond to his own thinking, but he also wanted to make something publicly agreed upon. So the people reviewed this over and they saw what happened. They said, the king saw something in the words, now we see it, and now he had to now do this plan in order that it would be something that was just in the eyes of the people too. The king was concerned about doing something which the people received as just. And he also was able to do this based on his great level of sensitivity to psychology. So that's it really shows a very fine point in his brilliance. All right, you see it?
Yes, that's amazing. I've never, I don't think, heard that idea before. That is really incredible.
Yeah, I mean, you get knowledge from God overnight. I mean, there has to be a tremendous amount there. You have to really study those areas. Now, this king with his knowledge, how is he acting? Well, what's the real level here? So not only was it the sensitivity that the woman always speaks about her own child first, and he picked up on that because he saw the order of the presentation was slightly different. It was reversed, actually, but to the onlooker, it sounded identical. But he showed a concern that the justice should be something that's that people see. And it says afterwards that the people were amazed at his wisdom. Interesting. Let's see. Well, I'm on this already. Where is that?
Do you know the reference to that story?
You mean the source?
Yeah, I was just trying to find it.
Yeah. Looking for that. Yeah, here it is. It's Kings 1, chapter 3. Verse 15. It's Kings 1, 3:15, and it says that it starts earlier. It's 3:5, and it says, in Givon, God appeared to King Solomon in a dream of the night, and he said to him, ask what I should give to you. So King Solomon said, you've made your servant David, my father, you've done great kindness with him, as he walked before you in truth and in righteousness and in a perfect heart, with you, and you watched him, you guarded the kindness, the great kindness, and now you've given his son to sit on his throne as of this day. Now he's referring to himself, of course. So he says, now God, my God, you have now caused me to reign as king, right? Meaning, you have caused me, your servant, to reign as king in place of King David, my father. And I am young. I don't know all the goings in and goings out. He's only 12 at this point. And your servant, meaning me, he's continuing his response to God. And he says, your servant, right? I'm amongst the people that you have chosen. There are great many people that they can't be counted because they're so numerous. So please give to your servant a heart that can hear, to do justice, to judge the people, and to distinguish between the good and evil. Because who can judge such a great, heavy people? You know, such a numerous people. And this matter was good in God's eyes. That King Solomon asked for this. And God said to him, on account of the fact that you asked for this matter, and you did not ask for long days, and you did not ask for riches, or the souls of your enemies, but you asked to understand and to hear justice, I'm going to do as your word, and I'm going to give you a wise heart, an understanding, that like it, there was none before and afterwards, none will rise like you. And also that which you did not ask, I'm going to give you. I'm giving you riches and honor, that there was none like you amongst the kings all the days. Okay, and he goes on, and he says, and if you walk in my ways, and my statutes, and my mitzvahs, like your father David did, I will give you long years. And Solomon woke up, and behold, it was a dream, and he came to Jerusalem, and he stood before the ark of God, the covenant of God. And he brought up sacrifices. And he made a great big feast for all of his servants. Then two women came, who were harlots, to the king, and they stood before him. And they said, one woman said, "Please, my master, me and this woman, we were dwelling in this one house, and we both gave birth in this house. And it wasn't the third day to my birth that I, there was nobody else in the house, except for the two of us in the house. And there died the son of the woman, of this woman, that she slept on him. She lied down upon him and suffocated him. And she got up in the middle of the night, and she took my son from my side. And behold, O king, your maidservant, I was sleeping, and she put her dead baby next to me. Right, and I woke up in the morning to nurse my child, and behold, it was dead. And I looked at him, and I said, this is not my child that I gave birth to. Then the other woman spoke. And the other woman says, no, my son is the live one, and hers is the dead one. No, and then the first woman spoke back again, and she says, no, yours is the dead one, and mine is the live one. You see? So the first woman was the liar, because she said, she spoke about the dead one first. She says, yours is the dead, mine. And this is how they spoke before the king. And the king said, this one says that mine is alive and yours is the dead. And this one says, no, yours is the dead and mine is alive. Right? We're now at the Kings 1, chapter 3, verse 24. So the king said, take a sword, right? And they brought him a sword before the king. And the king said, slice the baby in half. Into two pieces, and give one half to each woman. And the Tomer Isha, and the woman who said her son was the live one, I mean the real mother, because her mercy overtook her. She says, "Please, no, give the baby to her, but do not kill him." And the other woman said, "No, to me." And to her it will not be. Cut the baby in half. And the king answered, and he says, give the child to this woman, and don't kill him. And all the Israel heard of the justice that he used, that the king judged, and they feared before the king, because they saw the wisdom of God in his midst to do justice. Amazing story. Now, I just want to see if the commentators say what specifically. Just give me one second.
Can I ask a question while you're looking?
Sure.
So I'm seeing something in this story that I've not seen before, and that is that it appears that the first woman who is making the long speech is the liar. So therefore, nobody ever did switch the kids.
Yeah, she did. But she's reversing the story when she's fabricating a lie here. You mean,
how do we know the kids were actually switched?
Oh, you mean to say that you're right.
In other words,
she's letting her, right, because if she had the baby in her hands, well, I'm not sure who's got the baby at this point.
So yeah, because what I've always thought, it was a case of, okay, the mother who died switched the kids, the mother whose kid died switched the kids, and now they disagreed and end up in court, and, you know, so forth. But if I read this as the first woman is the liar, and so the kids never were switched, but she's claiming that they were. In other words, what I'm getting down to is the motivation of the lying woman that she wants the live child, or she just doesn't want the other mother to have a live child.
Right, seems to be the latter, because she said,
yeah,
kill the baby. It could have been she wanted the live child at first, but then, you know, she gave in and said, all right, kill him. But you're right, it could be. See, we don't know where the baby is and whose arms the baby is right now. It'd be better for the, it would be better for the liar not to have switched the baby. Because then it supports her story. Look, she's holding my baby, the live one.
Right.
Right, you're right. Good point.
Okay.
So the doc doesn't say anything on that verse. Let me see here. According to both Rashi and the Radak, some sort of a heavenly inspiration told this to the king. Let's just see what else we got here. Yeah, the Metzudas David says the people were in awe because the king did this with wisdom alone. That's what it says. They're completely enamored by that. Let's see what they say on this verse 23. I think it's an important thing. Again, I mean, the answers are always going to be right there in the verses. And again, the very point that he repeats it, you don't need to repeat it. He heard it. It wasn't a long, speech. He heard, this one says this, and this one said that. So why does the Torah have to go and say they repeat it? So one view says that the rabbis learn from here that the judge has to repeat the claims. Meaning to make sure he has to repeat it openly in front of the litigants to make sure that they agree that he has got the facts right. So that's one reason why he repeats it. But I don't think that's, you have to stick with that as being the sole answer, because this is a very unique case. I mean, I'm not sure if there's other, I'm sure there were other cases where people came before judges and there was discussions. And like the daughters of Tzelefchad, that we just read it in yesterday's Parsha. There were no sons, so they didn't want the land to not be passed down to them. So they brought a case before Moses. Moses doesn't repeat over what they said. Here you have repeated, because I think it's the Torah is trying to tell you that this is really where the answer is. And it's very easy that just as the people in his court would have glossed over any distinction between the two claims, the reader of the Torah too can gloss over it. I mean, that's the very point over here. Since the very point is that the claims sound identical to the typical person, so now the Torah has to repeat it. So now it stops you in your tracks. How come here the Torah is repeating over where in all of the cases, the daughters of Tzelefchad, Moses doesn't repeat over their claim. They say they bring the question, and he brings the question to God. He doesn't repeat what they said to him, but here it repeats it. Maybe for that very reason, because that's the subtlety over here is what the Torah is trying to bring out in the very words. So it repeats the words to tell you this is where the answer lies. You see? There's a whole science to how to study the Torah. But the answers are right there.
Makes sense.
Yeah, it's amazing stuff.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It is amazing.
All right, any questions or comments?
We're good here.
Okay. All right, so we'll pick up next week, same time, and you'll send an email out just as a reminder for Tuesday at 10 o'clock Eastern, right?
I will.
Okay. All right, so let me wish everybody a good week, and again, the classes that we do here, we put them online, so should be online shortly if you missed any part of it, and I'll put it in the audio sections, this way you can access it there. Okay, so have a good week, everybody. I'll see you next week.
All right, you too, Rabbi. Thanks so much.
Okay, my pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.